With 7 billion people on the planet and more all the time, we are shrinking the open spaces. And today's guest would like to see the open spaces grow in size and become more like the wild areas that existed before people started moving out across the landscape. Dave Foreman has been an environmental activist for a very long time, and he's the founder of the Rewilding Institute, dedicated to doing what the name implies, rewilding parts of the landscape, with all the features of the areas that were once wild, including large carnivores. Dave Foreman is making several visits across southern Oregon over the course of the next couple of days, including this evening at 7:30 at the Stevenson Union at the Southern Oregon University campus. He'll be talking at Pacifica tomorrow evening in Williams and on Thursday evening, October 24th, in the afternoon, rather, at Ashland Public Library. So busy trip around the region for Dave Foreman. Dave Foreman, glad to have you back on the Jefferson Exchange.
Well, thank you, Jeff. I'm really glad to be here.
What got your environmental ethic going in the first place? I'm just curious to know about how you got so
interested. Oh, I wish I knew. It's always been there. I remember my mother reading me from Ernest Thompson Seton when I was a little kid growing up in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and I started reading him as soon as I could, and the Sandia Mountain Range rises up above Albuquerque, and it was always just my El Dorado, my terra incognita, and I could not wait to get old enough to start hiking around there. And, you know, the open scattered lots in Albuquerque at the time with prairie dogs and lizards and horny toads and all, I went out and played around with, but I really wanted to get up in the mountains where there were mountain lions and that sort of thing.
Sounds like you've always been fascinated by large carnivores.
I have. There's something about it, and maybe it's due. My dad was in the Air Force, and so we lived in a lot of places, and one of those was Bermuda. And after a hurricane there once when I was 7 years old, somebody was eaten by a shark just off the beach where I was, and so you know, maybe that's what did it, but that was quite exciting for a seven-year-old.
So you've always been impressed by the power of carnivores, but not necessarily afraid of them from the sounds of it.
Well, no, I spend a lot of time in northern Alaska up in the Brooks Range running rivers. My wife and I will be doing a month-long canoe trip next summer in the Arctic Refuge, and so, you know, we wake up and hear grizzly bear tracks or wolf tracks or wolverine tracks right through our camp during the middle of the night. The only thing that's ever bothered me has been a muskox, which is one of the most wonderful animals left over from the Pleistocene. It's sort of like an Arctic buffalo, and I got chased by a grouchy male a couple of years ago up there, and friend of mine on the trip said, you know, Dave, I can't think of any better place or way for you to die than to be stomped to death by a muskox here in the NOAA attack. And that was the best compliment I've ever gotten.
But it hasn't happened, obviously.
No, not yet.
And not even close from the sound.
Not even as slow as I am. The muskox was just trying to teach me a lesson.
Rewilding certainly seems to be hitting something of a peak in interest at the moment. And I know that that we first got onto it from an article in the New Yorker sometime last year that talked about the people who want to bring back the aurochs, the large old kind of cattle that existed centuries ago in Europe, as part of a larger effort at rewilding. There are some areas, I guess, in the lowlands of the Netherlands, for example, that have been given over to rewilding.
Yes.
So how long have you been interested in this in particular, and what does the concept mean in your words?
Well, and, you know, I'm probably best known in these parts anyway for Earth First and the Bald Mountain Road blockade many years ago.
1983, was it?
Yeah, 30 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
But even then, we were very interested in the ecological role of wilderness and of old-growth forest and listening to the new science of conservation biology. And so when I left Earth First in 1990, I got involved with Michael Soule and other leading conservation biologists to start the Wildlands Project. And that's where we put the pieces together to come up with the idea of rewilding, which is that we need big wilderness areas as habitat, big roadless areas. But we need, for them to be healthy, we need all the species back in them. And so it's things like ecosystem engineers, the beaver, and that sort of thing. And here, in the Siskiyou country, the mountain beaver, the Aplodontia, or whatever it's called, which not related to beavers at all, but is a little forest rodent that builds extensive tunnels. It turns out to be one of the most important critters for the health of the ecosystem. And so we find things like that. Then there are the large carnivores. And I know my friends here are all complaining about deer in the gardens, and I see the deer fences all over the place. And, well, there are too many deer, just like there are too many deer in the eastern United States. And a big part of that is because there are not wolves in the mountains around here, and there aren't enough mountain lions or mountain lions back east at all. And but from a standpoint of general ecological health, we learned in Yellowstone just how important having healthy wolf packs was when they were reintroduced.
I do want to get to that because that is a critical story that we need to spend a little time on. We'll do that when we come back from this break. We are talking to Dave Foreman of the Rewilding Institute. He's got three appearances set up in the Southern Oregon region over the course of the next 3 days. But he's here live on the Jefferson Exchange, and you can join our conversation here. Back with Dave Foreman and your questions and comments here on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 25. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service, I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Dave Foreman, the founder of the Rewilding Institute. So we're talking about the very concept of rewilding, which talks about creating new and larger wild areas, larger than the designated wilderness areas that tend to exist in national forests and so forth today. You can join us here on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about the concept. Phone numbers here, 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, or by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So we were just beginning to broach the subject of wolves and the need for large carnivores as part of the ecosystem, because without them, you essentially have a puzzle with a couple of pieces missing.
Right, and you begin to have the ecosystem collapse. And Yellowstone National Park is probably the best known example of that, where the Park Service in the 1920s went to war against predators of any kind. They wanted to have the good animals for tourists to watch. And so not only did they kill off all the wolves and mountain lions in Yellowstone National Park, they were also killing pelicans because they were eating the fish that had been planted for recreational fishermen and just anything with sharp teeth. Mm-hmm. And so over decades, the beavers disappeared from Yellowstone National Park, and the reason for that is the willows along the streams were all browsed away by elk. There were too many of them, and they had nobody to move them around, and so they just hung out in the stream bottoms and ate away all the willows. Moreover, there were no aspen sprouting up because the elk just nibbled them off as soon as they got there. But when wolves were reintroduced into Yellowstone in 1995, just bam, the elk woke up. They were looking over their shoulders. Who are these guys? And they couldn't hang out chewing their cuds and gossiping with their buddies in the bottomlands anymore. They had to go hide in the tall timber. And lo and behold, willows have come back along the streams. Beavers have recolonized the park. There's research showing that songbird populations are up, that populations of small carnivores like mink and weasels and things like that are up because the wolves have knocked the coyote population down, which preyed on these small carnivores. And so all kinds of things have happened in Yellowstone National Park, all for the good. And indeed, some professors here in Oregon, Ripple and Beshta, have done the best work studying the impacts of wolves in Yellowstone and thereabouts. And there are scientific papers and journals all over the world have really created the basis for what we know about the impact of wolves.
So how different would a good experiment, first of all, is there a good experimental area for rewilding going on now? Or are the wilderness areas enough for that?
Well, I think, you know, the wolves that have been moving into Oregon and the wolf that went through southwestern Oregon and then into northern California.
OR7.
Yes. And it was really funny because it ended up in the Ishi Wilderness in Northern California. My wife, when she was a nurse at Chico many, many years ago, worked on the Ishi Wilderness, so we were really happy about that. So I think this area is a perfect example, and we've got deer out of control and other things. And so I would hope that Oregon can be a little more progressive and a little more sensible and how it approaches wolves and some other states like Wyoming have been. And that given half a chance, wolves will come back into Oregon, but we really need to sort of jumpstart that with some reintroductions, I think.
Let's set the farmer and rancher equation aside for just a second and just talk about folks living in town, for example. I passed two deer this morning, one on foot walking at my house a few miles from Ashland, and one in the car who didn't really want to get out of the middle of the street in Ashland. All right, so people are talking about being annoyed by the deer, but they'd probably be a lot more fearful if there were wolves running around. Are you proposing wolves even within cities and towns?
Oh, no. No, and they wouldn't. They're going to stay away, but the impact they have up in the mountains is going to have an impact down here as well. And it will cause the deer to be much more afraid. They won't be quite so in your face as they have been. But there are just a lot of problems the way we've upset nature, and certainly Ashland has created wonderful habitat for deer.
Absolutely. Everybody grows things green and they all get munched.
Right. Exactly.
So wilderness areas as they currently exist, you know, in the case of the Calamiopsis, it's a couple of 100,000 acres, right? Is that a kind of place that could be a good rewilding area?
Oh, sure. Sure. And particularly if it was linked up. My friend Dave Willis, who works so hard on the Siskiyou Crest and the National Monument there and all, is working on plans to try to link the Calamiopsis up to the Cascades, to Crater Lake National Park and that sort of thing. And that's the type of thing that needs to be done along the Siskiyou Crest and then down into the Siskiyou Wilderness and the Salmon Trinity Alps and that sort of thing in California. There's a huge area here of 6 or 7 million acres that's scattered with big wilderness areas. And if they could be tied together by safe linkages, you know, how do they get across I-5? Well, road engineers know how to do that now. And we're doing it in a number of places. It just requires the commitment to do it. And so this is one of the easiest areas in the United States to link up wilderness areas and national parks and have the whole Oregon Cascades tied in to what's here in southwestern Oregon and northwestern California.
I have seen pictures of the wildlife bridges in Alaska and Canada as well. And in fact, that brings up this email from Mike in Medford, who says, I have two questions. Does Medford intersect any wildlife highways, in quotes? And if so, is there anything we can do to create a path for the wildlife? Also, I have seen wildlife-specific overpasses, what we were just talking about. And would these be beneficial to I-5? Thank you, and thank you so much for the work you do. Again, this is Mike in Medford.
Okay, thank you, Mike. In a lot of cases, there have been the overpasses built, and the ones in Banff National Park, Canada, have been photographed. Just about every different animal that lives in the area has been photographed using that overpass now because it's been vegetated with to look like, you know, a nice bridge for critters. And in New Mexico, we have a real problem with the Interstate 40 going through a canyon just east of New Mexico that really boxes it in. And a lot of deer, bears, mountain lions have been killed on I-40, but local folks working with the highway department, working with the Forest Service, worked out a series of underpasses where a stream grows under, fencing along the freeway to funnel the animals into the stream underpasses, and it's worked very well. There's a lot of things road engineers know how to do now, and the great thing about engineers, you throw them a problem, and they enjoy figuring it out, and this has been done. And different kinds of critters need different kinds of passages. And so we know how to do it.
Dave Foreman's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He is the founder of the Rewilding Institute. So we're talking about the process of rewilding. Dave Foreman will be at the Stevenson Union at Southern Oregon University tonight at 7:30, at Pacifica in Williams tomorrow night at 7, and then on Thursday at 1 in the afternoon at the Ashland Public Library. You can join us here and now on the Jefferson Exchange. The phone number is 800-838-3760 anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. And our email address, jx@jeffnet.org. Here's Peter in Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Dave Foreman.
Hi, thanks for the show. I just wanted to get Dave's feedback on a conversation I had with somebody a week or so ago who was just up in the Joseph area. And he had mentioned that his sister's been living up there for umpteen decades, and since the wolves have been reintroduced up there, he said that they're practically going out of business because there's he actually said he's seen this where he said people who say that wolves don't kill for the fun of it or are full of it, that he's seen like tens of elk where they just killed them and then maybe, I don't know, ate their tongue or something and then moved on. But anyway, clearly it's a problem to the ranchers up there, and I wonder what the solution, as you see it, is. I'll leave it at that. Thanks for the show.
Appreciate that, Peter.
Okay. There's always a lot of exaggerations from people about the behavior of wolves, and really the only large mammal I know that kills for fun is us, Homo sapiens. That wolves can, once in a while, kill more than they can eat. Mountain lions do, but then they cache the kill and eat it later. But I think there's been an awful lot of exaggeration in the northern Rockies, and that includes northeastern Oregon as well, about the impact of wolves on elk. If you look at the real figures, there's still more than enough elk in the habitat. As far as livestock goes, yeah, there can be a problem there if people do free-range ranching. A friend of mine, though, a rancher in New Mexico, fourth generation, said he welcomed wolves back because they would help herd his cattle around to different parts of the ranch. He wouldn't have to do it. And he has dealt with predator problems, such as with coyotes, by just having his cows calve in April instead of March. In March, there's no wild food for coyotes, and most people calve then, so naturally the coyotes come in. But in April, coyotes are out eating all this wild food that's come up, and he's had no problems. And so he says that if ranchers will just pay attention to the ecosystem and try to work with it, they can figure things out. And certainly in Europe, one of the ways people are dealing with expanding wolf populations, and let's face it, there are 2,000 wolves in Spain right now. How do sheep farmers there deal with it? Well, they bring the sheep in to lamb and are protected instead of this sort of range livestock industry where we just turn the animals out at one point in the year and hope to go out and round them up later, sort of a lazy person's way of herding livestock. And so I know plenty of livestock operators who don't mind wolves or mountain lions at all, that just do a better job of understanding how to live in the community with wild things.
It sounds like they'd have to be a lot more interventionist, though, and potentially they'd have to spend more time and potentially more money on raising their flocks.
Well, indeed, more time. There's also a variety of programs set up, both by private groups like Defenders of Wildlife and some states and the feds, to reimburse ranchers for losses to predators. But let's face it, in a lot of cases, we're talking about public land and people ranching on public lands with permits that are below market value. And I think that in those cases, that the public's right to the land is just as much as the rancher's right, and that people need to figure out how to live, how to work things out with restored wildlife.
I want to point out that call was about the wolf pack near Joseph, Oregon, not Josephine County. So just in case people weren't, that's in Wallowa County,
right
in northeastern Oregon, where there is an active wolf pack. OR7 has been really the only wolf west of the Cascades thus far, and I haven't seen any reports lately on where OR7's hanging out.
And I don't think OR7 really was causing any problems other than people hoping to get a chance to see it.
No, and it was interesting to watch the way that people sort of embraced OR7.
Right.
OR7 became a real celebrity, and in fact was when Jack Owen was still the political cartoonist at the Oregonian, he was ending up there on, seemed like, a biweekly basis.
Uh-huh.
You know, OR7 for governor, stuff like that. So it was cute for a while, but then when you start talking about actual packs of wolves and things like that, is there a critical mass? Is there, first of all, a plan for a rewilding test plot somewhere? And second of all, is there like an optimum number of acres for that plot?
Well, no. I mean, it's really talk, though. The reintroduction of wolves in Yellowstone was effectively a rewilding effort. But to truly do it, you have to look at the land base as well. The interesting thing about carnivores is that they don't overpopulate. They expand to the territory, and mountain lions, for example, if you leave mountain lions alone, the old toms run the place, and they don't bother livestock. But young cats that come along, the old toms are going to run them out of the territory or kill them. And in fact, the greatest predator on young mountain lions is old mountain lions. But if you go in and severely hunt mountain lions and kill off the old toms, you upset the whole community. And so you have a bunch of young mountain lions running around that don't know what to eat, and they cause problems. But if you leave the old ones in place, they run the young ones off, and the whole breeding operation slows down as mountain lions all get territories. And so they control their own populations. And wolves pretty much do the same thing. There was a lot of inter-wolf hostility in Yellowstone between different packs that were squeezing up against one another's territories. And so, unlike people, wolves, mountain lions, and other carnivores will maintain a certain density in their area and won't get overpopulated. And once you get established packs of wolves or established old mountain lions, they will prey on wild animals. They're going to learn to stay away from livestock and that sort of thing. But we always go in and discombobulate the system and don't let the stability occur.
So it sounds like if you were going to start a major rewilding project, you'd have to have some serious help from wildlife biologists at the start to be able to do things like determine who are the old mountain lions, who are the young ones, and so forth.
Exactly.
To get it set up correctly.
Exactly. And we also really do need to look at Europe, where there are wolves in Germany and Switzerland. As I said, 2,000 wolves in Spain. There are wolves 60 miles from Rome in the Apennine Mountains. There was even a wolf that showed up in the Netherlands for the first time in 300 years. There are people who own large properties in Scotland who would like to have wolves and lynx back on their property. And so in some ways, Europe is trying to rewild itself, and I just find it amusing that these effete Europeans can tolerate large carnivores better than the manly men of the American West.
Huh. All right. Well, it sounds like we had a little slap to the cowboys there. We'll come back and take up their side of things when we return. Dave Foreman's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He is the founder of the Rewilding Institute. We'll talk more about rewilding and take your phone calls and emails when we come back. But as we go to the break, let me remind you, it is Fall Fun to Drive 2013 here on Jefferson Public Radio. If you listen to public radio, please support public radio. You do that by calling 888-552-6191. 888-552-6191, or make your pledge online at ijpr.org. Make that call soon, and thank you. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is Dave Foreman. He is one of the founders of Earth First and the founder of the Rewilding Institute, which takes as its major aim the idea of rewilding, converting large areas of landscape to more wild formats, which would include large predators, which is one of the reasons that rewilding can be somewhat controversial. Join us here on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about the concept. 800-838-3760 is our phone number anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. By email, jx@jeffnet.org. So this you were just talking about the fact that even Europe seems to be embracing rewilding. Is a little variation country by country, do you perceive?
Oh, yeah, there really is. France, for example, does not particularly like it. But Germany does, Italy, Eastern European countries particularly. In fact, on the Poland-Belarus border, there's a large preserve where the European bison still exists, and they are trying to bring in other extinct species there, including breeding back to the aurochs, which was the ancestor domestic cattle that became extinct about 1600 AD. There's an effort in Siberia called Pleistocene Park. A Russian biologist named Zimov, who has gotten muskoxen and bison from Alaska and Canada, and is trying to bring back all the critters that would have been in Siberia 100 years ago, but he also is really interested in the possibility of mammoths being brought back through cloning and genetic stuff and having them there. So he's got a very ambitious attitude. And so we see this all over the place. In Africa right now, on the border of Zimbabwe, Botswana, Namibia, and Angola, they are putting together a huge collection of reserves with wildways, as we call them, between those. And it's allowed elephants to repopulate Angola, which had wiped out all of its elephants in the past, because right now there's overpopulation of elephants in Botswana, and so they're happy to go somewhere where it's safe. And so even in Africa, which we think of as you know, the last great wilderness with all the big animals left, there's rewilding going on. The same thing's happening with South Africa, Zimbabwe, and Mozambique, expanding the areas around Kruger National Park to be about 15 million acres of a single national park, and taking down the fences on the borders. And so there's some very ambitious efforts. I know of efforts in overpopulated India, where they're trying to link up tiger reserves, because right now the tigers in India are split up in separate populations in a couple of dozen reserves, and so they're becoming inbred. They can't get back and forth to them, so there are some places in India where these wildways can be recreated that would allow tigers from one population to intermix with others. So it's quite fascinating what's going on around the world. Same thing's happening in the oceans, where there are ocean reserves being done with no fishing allowed, and trying to figure out how young fish get from one place to another. There are corridors in the ocean, we learn. The other thing, when you have no fishing zones on reefs, it creates better fishing opportunities outside. And so some fishermen who were opposed to these set-asides now are in support of them.
Let's take a call. We have Nicole in Ashland on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Dave Foreman from the Rewilding Institute.
Hello again. I just wanted to thank you, Dave, for your work with Earth First. It was an important organization while it existed.
Well, thank you.
It's an important purpose.
Thank you. That was a long time ago. I looked a lot different then. I thought the picture of me from the Earth First days in the newspaper yesterday was pretty funny.
Well, we all change.
Yes.
Times. But I just wanted to say about rewilding, it's a wonderful concept, but I'm sort of concerned about if it will just become, unless a lot of state laws are changed or the government steps in for a change, if it will just become an opportunity to slaughter more wild animals.
Well, that's why citizens have to stay engaged. That's a key thing. And everywhere I know about rewilding efforts in the United States, across the country, it's citizen groups doing it, and with friends in the agencies, but it's not really a government-run thing. It's a citizen effort right now, and we have to stay involved in everything. Once we get a wilderness area designated, citizens have to keep watching that wilderness area to make sure that the agencies don't overmanage it, that they're stewards instead of managers, that we're guardians and not gardeners of the wild places. And so we're all important, and that's why I keep at it, and why I think a lot of people here in southwestern Oregon have been at protecting the land for many, many decades. That's what's needed.
Nicole, thanks for the question. Appreciate that. Second reference then to Earth First, and you're dealing with that. And I had to ask about, I don't know if you saw the Medford Mail Tribune today, but the major editorial was about you.
Oh, really? No,
yes,
I didn't see that.
Slamming you in essence, as having a lot to answer for your activities with Earth First. Do you have any particular regrets about things you did back then?
Oh, you know, that was, that was 30 years ago. I've learned a lot since then. I think there are things we would have done differently. But by the same token, without the Earth First effort on the Bald Mountain Road, I don't know if there ever would have been a national campaign to protect ancient forest. Because when we looked at what was going on with the Kalmiopsis in 1982-83, the Sierra Club had tried a lawsuit to protect it. That had failed. People had sort of given up on protecting old growth forest. We thought we had lost the battle. And the effort of a lot of folks here in southwestern Oregon to protect the old growth and then throughout Oregon led to a national campaign. And while we're seeing with the proposals on the ONC lands to weaken protection of old growth right now, I think millions of acres of old growth forests in the Pacific Northwest, the Northern Rockies, the Southwest, California, and other places happened because of those early efforts by Earth First. And did we go overboard in cases? We probably did. But I think on balance, we did an extraordinary job. And any violence was done by the other side. Let's remember that. I still have the world's record for the backwards uphill truck-assisted 100-yard dash when I was run over by the truckload of bulldozer jockeys. And other people were buried in dirt by bulldozers. And fortunately, the owner of the road construction company on the Bald Mountain ordered his people to quit doing that. And so that's where the violence has come from. I've never threatened anybody's life, but I certainly have gotten a lot of death threats myself. So we need to look at where the real extremism is, and it wasn't really from Earth First.
Let's say we have a final email here from Scott Notown, given back to the concept of rewilding. He says, although I sympathize with many of your guests' points, attributing the growth in urban deer populations to the decline in large predators seems misguided. 40 to 50 years ago, there were fewer large predators in Oregon than there are now. The mountain lion population had been almost exterminated and was less than 5% of its current level. At the same time, deer were abundant in the forests and mountains because of the lack of predation, but rare in cities. The tremendous comeback of predators in Oregon over the last 40 years, as well as other factors, has substantially trimmed Oregon's overabundance of deer, but created for urban dwellers the appearance of a population increase as deer have moved to safer habitats in our backyards.
Well, that's a good point, and I think it calls up something I haven't been able to talk about, is that we need a lot of different solutions to the problems we have. The deer in urban areas is caused by many things, such as the good habitat we provide for them in cities, the fact that they seem to be safe here and safe from predators in the mountains, and we need to do something about it. Unfortunately, sometimes our desire to protect animals goes a little overboard, and we don't want to hurt Bambi in the city, but Bambi in the city is going to get run over. It's going to cause all kinds of problems, and we need thoughtful, humane ways to deal with overpopulation of deer in cities as well.
Dave Foreman, thanks so much for joining us today. Dave Foreman will be appearing at the Stevenson Union at Southern Oregon University tonight at 7:30, at Pacifica in Williams tomorrow night at 7, and then Thursday afternoon at 1 at the Ashland Public Library. From the Rewilding Institute, Dave Foreman, thank you so much.
Thank you, Jeffrey. I really enjoyed it.
Pleasure to have you back. Let us turn our attention back again to Fall Fun to Drive 2013, and we'll talk about what's been going on here at Jefferson Public Radio in terms of trying